All set? Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. My name is Bob Lewis. I'm chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight. I also want to thank BMO Financial Group for its ongoing support of this series, which we run in the fall and the spring. I want to say a little, make a little plug for our gala on June 7th here in Toronto at the Royal York. This is one of our prime ways of funding a lot of the administrative activities we take on, like this series. Our management, executive management program with Rotman. Our two websites, JSource and Projet J in Montreal. And so if you are inclined to have a fun evening schmoozing and celebrating good journalism, please consider buying a seat or persuading your friends to get a table. We'd love to have you. I'm also pleased to welcome a national TV audience following us on CPAC, the cable industry's public affairs channel. So tonight we tackle the subject of participatory journalism, and you can follow us on the hashtag CJF Forum if you want to. We're in a world of instant citizen feedback, bloggers, virtual story meetings. Last February, when John Payton was here, he described the situation at the Register Citizen in Tarrington, Connecticut, which has a truly open newsroom. In fact, the public is not only free to come into the newsroom, sit down and use the computers, but to participate in these story meetings, which of course is a frightening concept for a lot of us old line journalistic editors, but it seems to be working well for them. My friend Jesse Hirsch has started what he calls Campaign College at his Academy of the Impossible in the West End of Toronto, and last the last session or so, Councillor Adam Vaughan mused about taking a run for mayor next time, and the story was picked up by the Toronto Star. Marcus G. in the Globe, who's doing a wonderful job at City Hall, and has created a whole lot of new interest in that beat. Now it's easy, but anyway. he recently did a piece on the exploits of a talented network of bloggers who are keeping City Hall honest here in Toronto. And of course, we all know about the impact of social media in the successful mayoral campaign of Nenshi in Calgary. These are just a few of the kind of innovations that are confronting conventional journalism. And some of you may ask, indeed, what about editorial standards and quality when there are no editors, when there are no gatekeepers? What about the typos and the grammar and the spelling? And how are the big media gatekeepers coping with all of this? Well, tonight, we've got four of them here to explain it all to us. And we have our very own gatekeeper here, our moderator, Wilf Dinnick. He's the founding editor and CFO of Open File. It's a network of local online news sites, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. It's a collaborative news site, and the motto is, your story is the news on Open File. You suggest a story, we assign the reporter, and together, we shape the local news. Wilf has worked for the three major English-Canadian TV networks. He's also been an international correspondent for CNN and ABC News. He's covered the war in Iraq, Afghanistan's first elections, the tsunami in South Asia, and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. Now he's back home, part of a new revolution. Please welcome Wilf Dinnick.
Thank you very much. This is really exciting for me for a bunch of reasons. First of all, thank you for that kind introduction. I know it was a slip of the tongue, but I am definitely not the CFO. My investor would attest to that. It's fine. For us at Open File, for some of you who know what Open File is, and Bob just explained it a little, we are focusing solely on participation, trying to get the public involved in local news, get them engaged with ideas and content, and figure out how to monetize that. We think we're well on our way, but tonight's exciting for me because I get to go to school on some of the best and the biggest in the business. And I think what you'll see tonight, and what I hope to prompt questions from these guys, is exactly the things Bob was talking about. And I'm sure they'll be kind to their bosses, but I'm sure for the last 5 years they've been yelling and screaming about participation, about engagement, about what's going to happen. And now their bosses are coming down from carpet land and saying, oh, we've got to get more participation. We've got to get more people engaging with our brand. And I know that they're probably sort of banging the table thinking, yeah, I know. But how do you monetize that? How cost effective is it? And furthermore, how do you not denigrate your brand? I mean, it's more than just spelling mistakes. The most popular thing for user-generated content is cat videos. I mean, do we want that on the Globe and Mail? No. So what do we want on the globeandmail.com, and how do we engage people to keep the eyeballs there that matter? And I think for too long, and I think everyone in this room would agree, this profession has been a real echo chamber. We've all sort of talked to one another about what we think the right, you know, what information the public should know, and what we think that they would like. And that really is, as I said to my partner at Open File, Kathy Vey, we flipped that model. And it's really starting to change. We're starting to hear from people what they want. And how do we keep our brand and the important work that is behind all these guys at these important brands to continue the work that they do without, again, denigrating. And as I said, we really live in this echo chamber. Last December, I was invited very quickly, to New York to talk about Open File at this big participatory journalism conference. And as you can imagine, the Open File travel budget is very small, and they had offered to fly me to Manhattan and put two nights in a hotel. And of course, I tap danced there to do that. So I went and I jumped on the plane and got there. But there was a massive snowstorm, and it was the last plane in. And the taxi basically skidooed to the Paley Center where I was to talk, and I get there. They hadn't closed the conference down, but I got to the auditorium where I was to speak, and there was one other guy there. It's like 500 seats, one other guy. So I introduced myself, and he said, you know, I've come all this way. I'd love to hear what you have to say. So I thought, okay. So there I was. I was giving my talk with the slides, and there's one guy right there. And so, you know, at the end, I said, any questions? And sure enough, he put up his hand, and he threw a couple of questions my way. And he also runs a site. And so I said, well, anyway, great to meet you, and would you like to go for a beer? And he said, you're going nowhere. I'm the next presenter. But I was joking there with him afterwards that that actually it kind of feels like that, isn't it? We all talk to each other about what works and what doesn't work. And for the first time, we're really getting feedback from people online, from the readers, what they like, what they think is important, and how do we handle that. And as I said, a great panel here tonight. I think most of you guys know the people up here, but we'll just go over their bios and their history very quickly. Dan Dunsky, I think he's the executive producer of The Agenda with Steve Paikin, and I think what is a credit to him, he's really led the charge with that show. He is doing now what I think most big brands hope will end up with how their content works, which is, if I'm right, you have a good chunk watching the show, but you have a larger chunk audience participating online, social media, and engaging in all the other platforms. And they take the show on the road. They make sure it's hugely available on social media. Not only the content, but the way to engage with Steve Paikin, the host. And I think also, I would say, at least from my perspective of a journalist I look up to, Steve Paikin was one of the first to really, you saw the power of his G20 Twitter reporting. And he did a really nice balance of giving his opinion with still reporting what was going on. And I just know by the numbers, and when we storified his tweets on our site, it just was one of the biggest visited pieces of content we did all year. So you can see the power of a person reaching out of broadcast, out of their what they're usually comfortable with, and reaching whole new audiences. So that was really exciting to see. So amazing innovation. I look forward to that. And of course, Rachel Nixon, no small job there, Rachel. I don't know how you do it. I run 7 small little sites, and then I look at what you have to do, and I think, I'm glad I do what I do. Rachel is the director of digital media for CBC News, and that includes a whole bunch of things, as you can imagine. Mobile strategy, part of the management team. Figuring out how you take some of that excellent content, some of the best in the country, and communicate it in a smart and safe way. They also have, you know, people say, well, OpenFile's so innovative and you guys are doing such great stuff. But, you know, all the stuff that we do really is on places like the CBC. You can ask reporter questions. You can interact with the personalities there. And I know Rachel and the team, because I know a lot of them, have pushed the reporters and a lot of the producers to really get engaged in the digital side in amazing ways. And as we all know, working with reporters can be like herding cats. So it's just an amazing thing that what Rachel's accomplished. Andrew Lundy, I've known for, I think, about 2 years now, and it's been great to get to know him, but his history, too, is wildly impressive. Right now, Andrew runs 11 local news sites for Global News and for Shaw. Before that, and he's, of course, in charge of the flagship show, Global National, all the content that goes on there. But, of course, before that, he was editor-in-chief of MSN. And I think of some of us in a traditional, big, sort of brand news outlets forget the power of places like MSN and Yahoo, and they have a tremendous audience on their news pages too, so that was a huge responsibility. And of course, before that, CBC.ca and the sports, and of course dealing with those small brands like Hockey Night in Canada and Olympics and stuff online. So Andrew is one of those guys that I was referring to, really beating down the doors, the traditional doors, and trying to get people to participate with Shaw and Global in new ways, so really impressive. And of course, Jen McMillan. Jen's job, but she's the senior communities editor at the Globe and Mail. One of the big challenges here, and I'm sure because I've worked in these big places, and I think somebody said this to me once, I was saying this to a friend, that working at a big company, you can feel like you're being waterboarded every day. And working at a small company feels like you're being punched in the face every day. And I think for Jen, I can't imagine how hard it is to push those boulders up a very conservative, but very smart, engaged conservative audience like the Globe and Mail. The stuff that Jen is doing with Catalyst and Time to Lead is wildly impressive. It's an example of a brand, the Globe and Mail, that is terribly valuable. It's terribly valuable to the advertising. And you can imagine the management wanting to be very careful as they bring down those walls and let people in and how that looks. I mean, we all know what happens on the comment boards when you bring up the Israeli-Palestinian situation. You can't imagine things that are also close to people's heart in other news issues. So a huge challenge to Jen. So anyway, welcome the panelists. We're going to, the format here is they're going to give a short presentation about how they see participatory journalism working for them, their challenges, and where they're going. And then after that, I'm going to throw a few questions. And this is, of course, participatory. So it's essential you guys ask hard questions. And don't go easy on these guys, because they're journalists, and they usually have to answer to their corporate bosses, so they know how to get around a question. So they'll be good at that. So you can nail them home. Dan, do you want to go first? Is that okay? Okay, so you go ahead.
Thanks very much, Wilf. Can you hear me? Okay. Thanks very much for inviting me. I'm happy to be here. I should say that I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, so sorry, or you're welcome, depending on as the case may be. I'm going to just lay out very briefly some thoughts on the trend that we're seeing. I'm going to describe briefly what we're doing and some of the initial kind of lessons that we've learned. My thoughts on the trend that we're seeing, whether you call it participatory journalism, citizen journalism, public journalism, and I think that the term itself is slightly problematic, but whatever you want to call it, this growing demand for regular individuals to be involved in editorial choices is not going away. And except for a few highly specialized media outlets, organizations that do put their heads in the sand and ignore this phenomenon likely won't be around long enough to realize the mistake that they made. Fundamentally, what has happened in a very short period of time, from my perspective, is that the barriers to access that traditionally the so-called professional journalists were privileged to control are eroding and collapsing. Technology, largely in the guise of phones now, and distribution channels, largely via social media, but the internet more broadly, have been opened. And anyone who has an eye for a story, which really all that means, in my view, is anyone who can mediate reality in an engaging way so as to inform people can now be a journalist. It's as simple as that. What that means fundamentally is, again, in my view, is we're witnessing the commodification of information, and that is fundamentally transforming our models of information delivery. If the old media model was based on scarcity, this newspaper, this broadcast, this magazine is the only place you can get this story, then the promised land of the new media universe that we find ourselves in right now is a market where you deliver the right content to the right person at the right place at the right time. And that is a fundamentally different universe. But nobody should fear. I don't think anybody's figured out how to do this yet, and certainly nobody's figured out how to make money on it yet. Some context. When we launched the agenda in 2006, the big media buzzword was Web 2.0. YouTube's oldest video was not even 18 months old. Facebook hadn't yet introduced its share button, and it only had 10 million users. The iPhone hadn't been invented, and Twitter was something that a bird did to attract a mate. And obviously, things have significantly changed, and that's only 6 years ago. Since then, obviously, as Wilf alluded to, we've done some things to address the explosion of participatory journalism. Three things that I really wanted to focus on today, and I'm assuming we can talk about more afterwards. The first thing is that we take social media very seriously. It's a moving target, and it is constantly evolving, but in whatever forms it comes up, it is something that we must take extremely seriously. And we understand that we have to engage our users on their terms, which again, for a traditional broadcaster, is a very significant shift in thinking. So where we were once, 6 years ago, just a TV program, a good one, but still just a TV program, a one-way medium, we are now increasingly a media platform. And that requires a significant, as I say, shift in our thinking. The second thing we did is launched something called Your Agenda, which I think, frankly speaking, has only had moderate success and has undergone various iterations over the years, but basically is an attempt to allow users to program our broadcast with the issues that matter to them, with the guests that matter to them, and in the editorial scope that matters to them. And those three things are sometimes difficult, as is, and I'll speak about this later, the merging of these two media, the online and social media and a broadcast. And then finally, as Wilf alluded to, we launched these specials called The Agenda on the Road, and I'm actually very, very proud of these. There were two-day specials, the first day of which was something we called an agenda camp, borrowing from the camp phenomenon. This unconference phenomenon where we bring people together, we invite people to join us and discuss an issue. So I'll give you an example. Last year for the Ontario provincial election, we ended up going to 5 different cities across Ontario. The first day was an agenda camp, between 50 and 100 participants at each location, self-selected, they come. We asked them a very simple question: what is the most important election issue for you or facing you? And how they want to organize their responses is completely up to them. And all we did was shepherd the conversation, but absolutely not editorially. And so that was a full day exercise where people gathered in small groups and fundamentally came to some kind of consensus about what the 1, 3, 10 big issues were for them. The second day, what we did is then took those issues and put it to elected officials or candidates for elected office on our broadcast. So our broadcast, in effect, was determined by the people who had participated in the camp the first day. We also invited the campers to be there with us to put questions directly to the politicians or to respond to politicians. And I think it was a terrific success with some caveats. But it was successful in the sense that we combined 3 different things, a public participatory event, a broadcast, and social media, because obviously if you were not in Ottawa or Sudbury, or the various other locations, you could participate, you can chime in with your phone. And I really liked it. What we've learned doing these things, we've learned a lot, but I've tried to distill it into 4 key points, is first of all, that information media is having its kind of postmodern moment, where we're witnessing the end of any kind of singular narrative. I'll tell you a brief story. In the weeks leading up to the Don Drummond report, for those of you who, for those of us who live here in Ontario, we know that it was wall-to-wall Drummond all the time. We did a program 3 days before the Drummond report came out on how young people consume news. And we had two very, what I would consider to be well-informed, they certainly would consider themselves to be well-informed, smart young people. One was doing a PhD, an MBA, and the other one was doing a master's. Neither of them knew who Don Drummond was. And not only that, but they were completely unembarrassed about the fact that they didn't know who Don Drummond was. And the reason is that their Facebook friends, their Twitter followers, were not talking about Don Drummond. They vaguely had some idea that the Drummond report was something important. But they just didn't know. It didn't cross the living room of their mind. So that kind of story encapsulates what, for us, or for the kind of work that I do, it makes multi-platform editorial decisions very, very hard. Who are you making decisions for? And it doesn't solve the gatekeeper problem. As much as we want to imagine that perhaps participatory journalism solves the gatekeeper problem, it doesn't. The issue of how we apportion importance to stories still exists. It just exists on a different level. The second thing we've learned is that a media organization, like a football team, needs, an air game and a ground game. An air game for us, our broadcast, is all about reach and the opportunity to talk to as many people as possible. Our ground game, social media in our case, is hard yards in football talk. It's time-consuming, but the effort is worth it. Once you've grabbed somebody, slowly you work and you are engaging with somebody in two ways via social media, it is a completely different... The relationship you have with that person is completely different than what you have over on a broadcast. The challenge, though, is figuring out how to coordinate the two. It's very, very tough. As far as the expanding stock of journalists that we hear about when we talk about participatory journalism, I think that there are, first of all, amateurs, some of whom I'd rate as highly as any professional journalist. There are obsessives who really know their stuff but drive you a little bit crazy with their zeal. And then there, frankly, are dilettantes who claim the mantle of expertise but frankly have no knowledge or interest beyond the superficial. And that's a problem. And I mean, frankly, you know, I'm a little bit tired of hearing about Sam or Joe's or Joan's pet theory of monetary policy. I don't know about you, but I've had enough of it. I alluded to at the beginning that I think the term participatory journalism is problematic because I think we know what participatory reporting looks like. I think that's what Tahrir Square is, and I think we can recognize that. I think it's a little different and a little trickier to understand what, say, participatory analysis looks like. And I'm not sure that, I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that because participatory journalism lacks traditional oversight, and not just for things like spelling, it's more important for putative journalists to understand their motivations for doing what they do to make sure that the kind of naturally egotistical world that we all inhabit doesn't become a narcissistic world. And that's a particular challenge that I think that we're only going to have to deal with a little bit more as we go forward in this world of participatory journalism. So
great. There's Thank my you initial thoughts. That's excellent. Thank you so much. Dan. Rachel, you have a PowerPoint. Do you want to come up here? That'd be great.
I do have a PowerPoint, and I apologize. Good evening. Let's move this down a little bit. I'd like to start with a question for you. Say you were taken hostage at gunpoint, and there's a danger that kidnappers may kill you before you're rescued. What do you do? Are you going to make a run for it, or are you going to wait to be rescued? This is one of the questions that we posed to viewers of the Fifth Estate a couple of weeks ago. It was a live interactive show that was intended to give an up-close insight into how police tackle kidnappings and the inherent dangers of those using a real-life case. Now, alongside the program, we had voting software to allow people to express their views online or on mobile at the same time as the show aired, including answering the question I just asked you. Now, perhaps you don't think of this as participatory journalism in its purest sense, but I use this example to make the point that we take a really broad approach to participation using a wide array of tools and techniques. We're aiming to go beyond what you might expect in terms of asking people to send in their photos or comments. Now, with the Fifth Estate on TV and an additional interactive presentation online, we wanted to stimulate the discussion in people's homes, as well as giving Canadians a sense of the discussion around the country. As we know, and I'm sure we're going to hear it a lot tonight, our role as journalists is really evolving, and the idea of the gatekeeper is long past. In fact, there probably isn't a gate anymore. Rather, an important part of our role is to facilitate informed discussions in a shared media space. So whether it's on the CBC News community pages or elsewhere on our digital platforms, our aim through participation is to build trust, grow loyal audiences, and provide ever more relevant content by reflecting a modern Canada. Very few of our stories now or projects are conceived without considering how our users can be included in our storytelling and reflected within the subject matter. What's great about the digital space is that there are multiple ways of including users in our coverage, and we can adapt those to different levels of effort and attention. To move on to another example, for the recent NDP convention, we deployed a new live coverage page on cbcnews.ca, part of which contained a live blog. So during the course of the day, as you'll know, the voting system crashed. And by crowdsourcing tweets and twit pics, We were able to report on this in our blog long before any of the competition, and in fact, before our news desk. And you can see some examples on screen here. Now, people on the floor wanted to share what was happening in real time. Alongside our own journalists, in effect, the people at the convention were co-creators of the story. Are those co-creators journalists? Mostly not. And in fact, most people don't want to be journalists or claim to be so. But with examples like this, I'd argue that individuals are committing acts of journalism from time to time. People are sharing their experiences all the time online, some of which we can tap into using tools like Storify. During the Mexican earthquake last month, we created a Storify which combined tweets from the time of the quake, plus connecting with people who posted twit pics of the damage. Now, the photos combined with the tweets from during and after the event make a compelling package of what happened. You don't get all the details of a wire story, but you do get a more human account of how it unfolded. In other cases, the conversation can be directed by us in a very active way. There have been a couple of examples lately where we've put out calls on Twitter that have resulted in extremely genuine and moving material. For International Women's Day, which is the example you see on screen there, we asked for Twitter advice from leading Canadians about what they would say to their teenage self. A variety of women, including Margaret Atwood, told us what they wished they'd known back in high school. And then we asked our readers what they themselves would recommend, both via Twitter and Facebook. We did something similar, in fact, with cancer survivors for Cancer Awareness Month recently. Now, the point with the NDP convention and the examples I've just given is that through combining content in formats like a live blog or a Storify, we're giving greater exposure to work that's already out there and being done, and creating a framework for understanding fragmented content. I'd like to move back in time a little bit to 2008, which is a very long time in digital terms, I realize. After I left the BBC and before coming to CBC, I was the news director for Now Public, which some of you may know is a participatory news startup in Vancouver. At the time, it was quite unique in terms of the size of its member base and the passionate contributing and international community. The subject areas that people wrote about didn't always reflect the traditional mainstream agenda. One of the many innovations we explored was whether in an age of dwindling resources and news gathering budgets, we could create a parallel global network of people who could be deployed whenever news broke, since technology had swept away the barriers to transmitting material in real time. The problem itself was real enough, and I think still is very real for people. But the issue here was that we were routinely expecting average citizens to drop everything and swing into action when required, acting as journalists. Now, it is possible to achieve this in our coverage, working together with citizens, but in a targeted and planned way, I would argue. During the G20 in 2010, the CBC News community staff assembled a team of citizen bloggers and journalists, CBC journalists rather, to bring Canadians a street-level view of what was happening in Toronto during the summit. And the result was an in-depth, real-time view of the impact of the summit that we hosted on our site and also on CBC News Network. Our bloggers chronicled life inside the security perimeter, the impact on their businesses, and the protests themselves, and so on. And more than 200 posts provided a well-rounded view of the story as it unfolded. So while this kind of coverage is achievable around big events, instead, where we typically find success on a day-to-day basis is not in trying to change human behavior, but in tapping into it. We're inherently social beings, after all. Just look at what's happening with YouTube. 60 hours of video being uploaded every minute, according to Google's Eric Schmidt. At a conference I attended last weekend, he really underlined those figures, saying that gives you a sense of the scale of human expression right now. Most of the content on sites like YouTube is not journalism, but in fact, viewing it in those terms, I would argue, is in itself a red herring. The issue for us is finding within this material the content that matters to a wider audience and making sense of it. Now, a key challenge in newsrooms is feeling like you always have to have the latest shiny bauble. Tumblr, Pinterest, Instagram, I could go on. But for us, the real value of social media is less in the current services and tools, and more about how these distributed but networked systems allow for interactions between users and journalists, and users to users without any intermediary. In other words, we're moving from a world that values only publication to one in which participation is crucial, and collaboration can bring greater benefits than individual authorship. So for us, it's not about a Twitter strategy or a Facebook strategy. Providing relevant content and experiences is really central to our mandate. Now, some of you may have heard that we're launching a digital service in Hamilton in the spring. And with that service, you'll see us moving even closer to our news community and having an even stronger integration of relevant content from CBC and from Hamiltonians themselves. In short, ensuring genuine engagement strategies in our coverage is increasingly central to how we work at CBC News, and I think that we're stronger and more relevant for it. Thank you so very much.
I'll wing this. Make sure our technology is working here. All right, I will reiterate an apology for PowerPoint, and mine is probably even more conventional than some of them. First off, I'll say that our approach to participatory journalism is probably more locally focused. I think Global News' strengths are largely local, much more in the West than they are national or international. We still have strengths there, but it's not sort of our prime focus. We have an immense amount of engagement already with broadcasts stretching from Vancouver through the prairies, a little less in Ontario in the East, but still there. So our digital plan kind of maps that. We've tried to leverage the existing kind of affinity people have with Global News on television with what's happening in social media. Our numbers have really reflected that. We have really high engagement scores and followers on things like Facebook, our Twitter, and overall numbers in the West. And so that's sort of been our focus. What I'm going to show you here is sort of two examples. The first, sort of a spot news, breaking news example, where we leveraged the strength of a community under siege, the Slave Lake fires of about a year and a half ago in northern Alberta. And the second one is much more, I think, more featurey, the Titanic 100th anniversary. And I'll walk you through them. The first one with the Slave Lake, we used Facebook, Twitter, and UGC through a live blog. And Rachel will talk about how they'd used a live blog for the NDP election. We use them fairly frequently, and they find them a really effective way to bring citizens into the story, let them tell their stories, and for us to get the message out more directly. So this appropriately, since I work for a broadcaster, is actually video. It was a video entry that we had for the Online Journalism Awards last year. We didn't win, but we did get nominated, and we're very happy about that. So I'm just going to let the video play. The guy speaking speaks better than I do anyway, so and I'm lazy, so... where's our technical guy? Oh, good.
Slave Lake, Alberta, spring 2011, a town on fire. Thousands flee, hundreds of homes are destroyed. Nearly a third of the northern Alberta town of 7,000 is burned to the ground. Compelling, major breaking story. GlobalNews.ca in Edmonton responded with the urgency the story deserved, leveraging an impressive array of online tools and tactics to cover the story of the Slave Lake wildfires as it unfolded. Among them, a live blog, moderated in real time, launched immediately and up for 72 hours. A live blog that became a vital information hub for those who needed help and those who wanted to provide it. The live blog generated almost 50,000 page views. There was Global Edmonton's popular Facebook page, a social hub with over 32,000 fans. It became a platform for solidarity as Albertans and Canadians across the country showed support for the thousands forced to flee their homes. There was the quick turnaround of vital information for those impacted by the wildfires, including a dynamic interactive map that charted exactly which homes had been destroyed. The web traffic results were a clear indication that GlobalNews.ca's coverage had a powerful impact. In the first 48 hours of the breaking news of the wildfires, Slave Lake fire stories accounted for 28% of total site traffic nationally, with over 450,000 page views. Breaking news is all about timely, accurate, and comprehensive coverage, delivering a true public service. Global News' coverage of the Slave Lake wildfires did just that, And we thank the Online News Association's Awards Committee for considering our submission in the Small Market Breaking News category.
I didn't have time to edit that last part out, so. Couple of notes about that. The live blog, we talked about it, how it was up for 72 hours straight, and that means we had to staff it for 72 hours straight. It's a pretty daunting task. So that kind of stuff is very resource intensive. We were never going to let people just put stuff up there. All of the information and comments were curated, had to pass muster. We didn't want people giving inaccurate information at a time like this. So we were checking it. Well, if it made sense to us, if it was in accord with what we knew, we would post it. Later on, we got to learn who to follow or who to allow in. They were the experts. I don't know if you know Andy Carvin, but the method he used to cover the Arab Spring for NPR last year was that he basically followed 20 or 30 very important on the street, on the ground people in Cairo, and from his office in Washington, I think covered the Arab Spring better than any journalist, especially the ones who were actually in Cairo, who were probably hemmed into their hotels or hemmed in by security forces. So we employed the same thing. We sort of figured out who we needed to get in contact with, who we invited onto the blog, and they formed a huge backbone of that information. And a lot of the other stuff you saw on those websites was information that was given to us by citizens and by emergency officials, hospital officials, firefighters. So the other part of that still resonates with us is the uptake in traffic. Edmonton before that was, amongst our regional sites, was about third or fourth, and a distant third or fourth. We kept almost all the viewers that we gained then. I think it really engendered a sense of trust that we know what we're doing online. And Edmonton skyrocketed into second place behind BC, which is our behemoth, and has kept that. The Facebook page, which already had 32,000 followers, mushroomed to just a little over 50,000 today. They own that page. It's very much theirs. We moderate it, but they now exchange community information on there. And so what started off as a tragedy has turned into a real sense of togetherness and sharing information in what is a relatively safe and popular space. So I'm going to switch over to the second feature. The 100th anniversary of the Titanic sinking was a big deal for us. Global Halifax is one of our smaller sites, but Halifax's role in the disaster and in the aftermath was just too good for us to pass up, and so we try to use this as a bit of leverage to inject some life into that site, but also to get some followers. To do that, and Wilf doesn't know this, but I've used this not because you're the moderator, but we partnered with OpenFile on this. The reason we did that was OpenFile is tremendously strong in Halifax. They have a very strong presence, they have a following. We don't, so we thought a partnership would be a great way to approach it. What it does is, OpenFile, for those who don't know, solicits information and story ideas and content from the public and curates it and then maybe sends it to reporters to grow into stories. We thought that partnership would work really well. So how the story started was, I was actually out in Halifax a year ago for the RTDNAs, went to one of the cemeteries where some of the Titanic victims were buried. Saw this tombstone with a hand-done sort of card. See that at the bottom there. This is one of the band members who played until the Titanic actually went under. Wondering myself, who would leave this? This person's been dead for 100 years, and we never quite found out. So when this came up, I thought, you know what? This might be a good way to track down who is putting flowers and who's doing these cards for it. So we launched this initiative, like I said, with OpenFile. We asked people to tell us your Titanic stories. We knew that Halifax was obviously a center for the recovery, for some of the burials, for some of the investigation, and as a maritime center, there was certainly a natural role for it to play. And we thought that even 100 years later, maybe people had family members, and that's exactly what we got. We've already done the partnership with OpenFile. I skipped ahead. The results were, we got submissions not just from Halifax, but from users across the country, which was really impressive to me. People who maybe had started in Halifax and had moved away, people who had family that might have been on the Titanic, or a couple of them actually supposed to be on the Titanic and lost their tickets or had a last minute cancellation and made it home later on a ship that actually got there. We generated 6 globalnews.ca stories out of this, stories that we actually did ourselves, whether it was text, photos, video, interactives. Open File also shared some of those stories and developed some of their own. We had an agreement that we would get dibs on this one and you could have the other ones and then we would negotiate. We turned this into two broadcast stories on Global Maritimes, and actually one of them ended up on Global National. And it's one of the first times that we've been able to create digital content that ended up as a broadcast story, which was a real coup for us to sort of get resonance with the broadcast teams. I'm sure all of you, you know, have struggled with that, that the digital part of our jobs can be marginalized, and this was a real way to get buy-in from them that, hey, we're real journalists, and B, we've got some really amazing stories to tell. So it was anchor content for the Global News Titanic site. We had interactives, but the Your Stories part was really the hub of activity. The example of that missing, or that the photograph and the flowers turned out to be a girl in Halifax who had autism and had just focused on this, had gone to visit the cemetery once, researched the name, found who it was, and decided that, like, no one's taking care of this anymore, and I want to do that. And so every week she goes out with her mom, and they put flowers down, and she's created this card that tells people who the person was. And that was of real interest, obviously, to Global National. It became it's a very heartwarming story. And so now we have the answer to that. And they actually, the girl met up with this victim's great-grandchildren who came over from Britain to meet her. It was quite a moment. And some of the other ones, as I said, the Halifax was a big part of the recovery. So we got a story from somebody who had said that their grandfather had been troubled all his life by what he saw when he was pulling bodies in, you know, from the Atlantic. And it still resonated with him 60 years after the tragedy. So that was, you know, we turned that into a very sort of immediate story that somebody in your community right now has had that effect. So it brought something that happened 100 years ago really into the fore. We would not have got either of these stories, I don't think, had we not, you know, approached it from a participatory journalism point of view. So overall, it was, you know, these are unique stories. These are stories I don't think we could get otherwise. And to the gatekeeper notion, the good thing is we're not letting them tell them completely unfettered. We'll filter them, we'll grow the stories. In a lot of ways, I think a lot of people want that. They want us to take the kernel of it and do what we do best, whether it's video or adding context to it. From a cost-effective and laziness point of view, it is lower effort. The amount of effort we would have had to expend to try to find these people, as opposed to using social media and companies like OpenFile to do it, was just not even comparable. So that can result, even though curation and moderation can be a daunting challenge sometimes, I think overall it does lower the threshold for how much effort you have to get to cover it. I'd probably say with Rachel and the G20 that team that you assembled was probably helped a lot in gathering the amount of information that sending a team of 25 or 30, you know, hardcore journalists out would have probably been more difficult to do. It certainly built community. I showed that with the numbers that we got with Slave Lake for sure, and with the retention of those numbers. The public service component, I think that we did sort of perform a public service by offering people a venue to get trusted information to contribute to it. And the social part of it that, as you know, as evidenced from the Edmonton Facebook page, people own this now. This is their digital home for discussing all things Edmonton. Just one quick, I'll give you a bit of a sneak peek as to what's next. We're about to launch our user-generated content initiative, kind of modeled after the CNN iReport. So I'm hoping it'll be next week. We're still ironing out a couple of kinks, but Global Ground Force is going to launch. It'll launch on every local site that we have, as well as on the national basis, allowing people to upload video, photographs, text, add commentary. There will be a gamification strategy, so people who are trusted will get higher ranked. And we're hoping that this will extend our eyes and ears, but will also help form communities. We have plans, for example, to cover local events like the Calgary Stampede, the PNE, Santa Claus Parade here, by using this, letting people, you know, tell their own stories or take photos and videos and send them to us so we can use that. So that's we're really embracing the concept of citizens. I'm kind of with you as not as journalists necessarily, but certainly as frontline reporters. They have stories to tell. They have experience now with media. We're by far not the only experts in taking video with iPhones and Blackberries. So that's sort of where we're headed.
Sorry, one moment. So the presentation I've got here, the way I approach this is sort of, I've been communities editor at the Globe and Mail for 2.5 years now, and so I'm just going to take you briefly through this whirlwind tour of the past 2.5 years in community at globeandmail.com. We're going to go very fast, so hold on. I just wanted to show this front page. This is actually just a photo I took on my phone, and it's a little weird. You can't quite see all the text over there because I was just so excited. And the text over there at the bottom, it says, "Follow Doug Saunders in Oslo all weekend on Twitter and tgam.ca, theglobemail.ca." This was very exciting for me at the beginning. So just an acknowledgement, as Wolf mentioned, the Globe and Mail often, people think of it as, it's good on business, it's good on politics, it's, it has a bit of an image as your dad's paper. So I've been really, really pleased to see over the past few years that we're doing some innovative stuff. We're really moving, and I think we're really changing a lot of how the newsroom works. And I think this was a great example of that. Doug Saunders, our European bureau chief, does incredible things on Twitter. He's just fantastic. And the fact that the Globe was saying, look, we have this asset that's online, that's digital, that's a service to your journalism. It'll keep you informed on what's going on with this disaster in Norway throughout the weekend. So this was a fun moment for me. This next photo, this is the lady in the picture there is a woman named Chantel Elliott, and she lives in Calgary. And as you can see, she has just a beautiful family. They're walking down the street in Calgary in their neighborhood having a great time. The reason I have this photo of Chantel is because she's a member of a program we call the Globe Catalyst, which Wolf also mentioned. Globe Catalyst was really a way that was beginning with the redesign that we launched in the fall of 2010. To do something innovative and new in terms of reaching out to Globe readers, instead of just sort of having a bit of a passive experience where people would come and comment or maybe follow us on Twitter or fan us on Facebook, we actually wanted to engage with readers, with specific readers, and ask them about our journalism, what they thought of our reporting, and actually involve them in the process in a very constructive way. So the way we did this, we reached out to readers, we invited 1,000 of them into a forum where they could connect directly with our journalists that was not part of Globe and Mail. It was kind of a closed community, a seed community, if you will, and had these really intensive discussions with them about what the redesign was going to look like in print and online, what their thoughts were. They actually shaped a lot of our redesign of our commenting system in the fall of 2010. When we rolled it out, we actually will say, Jeff suggested this change, and we thought it was a good change, and we did it. It's here. Chantel is a catalyst for July 2011. We actually did a project where we turned the paper for Canada Day over to readers and over to the catalyst, and we actually said to the catalyst, what would you like to see in the Globe and Mail on Canada Day? What do you think would be a good idea for us to cover? And Chantel's idea was, I'm really interested in seeing fantastic communities across Canada. I live in a fantastic community in Calgary. I want to, my neighbors and I do great things. I think we really kind of hold up some of those ideals of Canada that we celebrate on Canada Day. And, we tossed the idea around the newsroom, and everyone said, yeah, that is a really good idea. That's a great way to celebrate Canada Day. So Chantel actually sort of guest-edited in some ways the Canada Day issue of the Globe and Mail, which was very exciting for me. This one here, this is actually a comment. I'm sure many of you have seen the comments on globeandmail.com. They're mostly from me, actually. I'm just kidding. But this guy actually, this is a comment that was left, again, fall of 2010. If you can read it, he's basically, it's a bit of context here. This comment was posted on a story about Elections BC and a ruling they had made to basically disqualify a petition that had been filed by a citizen. What this clever commenter had found was that the rules that were disqualifying the petition were only added to the Elections BC website after the petition had been filed. So this clever guy pointed it out. One of our BC editors, Fiona Morrow and BC, our online editors, she was reading the comments, saw this, brought it up to the editors and staff, and there we go. There was actually reporting on it, and it was the story that we were able to break, thanks to that commenter who we communicated with and obviously did some reporting around it. But that was a nice moment. This is actually a story from this past Remembrance Day that ran in the Globe. The guy on the cover here on the front page is Ed Wadley. Ed did several tours of duty in Afghanistan, and we actually had just sort of launched a call out to our readers, said to them, you know, we're Remembrance Day is approaching, we're looking for ways to market. It's also was, you know, a momentous time in Canadian history with the Afghan mission winding down. And Ed sent us in, just via email, sort of old-fashioned tools, this fantastic first-person essay on his experience as an Afghan vet. And it was, we were just blown away. Like, myself and the other editors read the essay, and we were like, this guy can write. He can really write. So we contacted Ed. We sent a photographer up to his home and photographed him. And you know, there he is on the front page of the Globe and Mail for Remembrance Day, simply via, you know, a call-out on our website. This is actually a feature that we've got on our website right now, and I highly encourage all of you to go check it out. We're, as I mentioned, there's some examples here. I've talked about reporting and how we're crowdsourcing and bringing readers more and more into our journalism. We're also thinking more about ways that readers can actually engage with our journalism. We've seen a lot of fantastic examples already tonight. The Globe has this really, I think, from my years, you know, at the Globe, has this really special place among our readers in terms of they actually, you know, this is the place they turn to when they really want to debate something, when they want to discuss an important issue. They come to the Globe because they want to see what others who are, you know, thinking about these issues are saying. And they also feel like the Globe, I think, can connect them and give their views a bit of a higher profile among the people who matter in Canada. So we, for instance, did a recent call out where we asked our readers, said, what do you want to see in the federal budget? Very open-ended, you know. We actually just had, like, a tremendous response, and I'm going to get to that a little bit later. And we've also had a really great response with this feature. Just to give you some background, as you guys probably know, this year marks 30 years of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The way we're marking that is we've actually had Kirk Makin, who's just our justice reporter, and his mind is like an encyclopedia of the Supreme Court, and he picked out the 30 biggest cases in the history of the Charter. And we've actually turned it over to readers, our very smart readers, and they're voting on sort of what cases they think are significant in Canadian history and which ones have, you know, negatively impacted Canada. And you can hopefully, I think, Kristen is here, we'll pick up the Globe tomorrow to see some of the results, if our friends in print. But anyway, but yeah, but we've had like just a tremendous result. The comments are amazing, and people are really getting into this and debating it. And then this is Joel Capongo, and he's an 18-year-old student in Ottawa. He's an engineering student. I mentioned that call-out we did about the federal budget. Joel was one of the people who responded to our call-out, so he wrote in and expressed his concerns about the budget, saying, I really need to see funding for science and innovation. This is really important to me. I'm an engineering student. I want to work in Canada. I want to get a job. I want to do interesting things. And we just thought he had a really interesting voice, a great perspective. And so we actually included him in, interviewed him, sent a photographer to talk to him. But another example of how readers were able to ask readers to come to us and share their stories rather than spending a lot of time on the phone and trying to hunt them down. And that's it for me. Like I said, it's a whirlwind tour, but thanks very much.
All right, Jennifer and the rest of the panelists, thank you very much. That was fantastic. I think as you can see here, we've moved well beyond the concern that we're passing the torch just to citizens to do the journalism. I think we're so far beyond that debate, and I think you can see, especially the big brands and what they're doing, is using all these different tools to engage audiences in great ways. But it still poses a lot of questions. We're going to open the floor to questions in 1 second. I have one or two. The first question I have for Andrew and Jennifer specifically. You look at how this is evolving, and you're getting a tremendous amount, first you, Andrew, you're getting a tremendous amount of information, and you're admitting rightly that it takes a lot to curate that to make sure you don't denigrate your brand and somebody's saying something that's not ridiculous, not just to, you know, it doesn't tarnish the journalism, but also advertisers don't want to get in that wrong conversation. But what role, how has the role for your journalists changed, and has it changed? Are they now following what is being presented to them through these portals, and you're then assigning them based on that? Or are they out doing enterprise stories based on, I think I need to do a story on a piece of information that they need to know about? So question for you, is it changing the role of the journalist in your newsroom?
Yeah, it's starting to. I wish it did a little bit more. Right now, a lot of the journalists are still pretending that the 6 o'clock news is the first place people are finding out their information, and it's not. They're finding it online. And so that I've been pushing them to start to change the nature of the stories that we're going to put on a nightly broadcast to make them a little bit more reflective, more investigative, more advancing the story to the next level, as opposed to just taking what happened and sort of repeating it. From a lead point of view, yes, they are using the information that people are sending in to either follow up or reshape the story. It may be another voice, it may be a different angle, and it may advance the story sometimes. As long as they're careful about making sure that this is accurate.
Right.
One of the big dangers in digital is the it's easy to be very partisan and to mask that. You never know when, you know, it could be like a PC operative is sending you that information, or someone with an axe to grind against a mayor or a public official, let's say. You don't know the background of that person.
Right.
So it's a little bit difficult to suss that out.
Right, and I'm assuming what they do is then they contact the person if they want more information. And
that's what you've got to do. Yeah.
Jennifer, a question for you. You know, In our business, referral is becoming an increasingly as important or more important than search. So I'm looking for a story, and I go through my Facebook, Twitter feed, mm-hmm. and I don't necessarily, and I think this is their fear is that the future generations won't see the brands the same way we do, that they won't go to theglobeandmail.com to get the information, they'll use their Facebook feed. How do you, if that is the case, and I'm assuming that you agree with me, how do you start building that referral network, or is that an objective? I mean, how do you start making sure that people outside the paper know all the great work you're doing? Because as Dan pointed out, if you don't know who Dwight Drummond is, you're probably not, you know, reading some of the traditional media, which you should. So how do you reach to that? How do you get those other points of entry for those new audiences?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that, through discussions with readers and discussions with lots of people, I mean, I think there is always an appetite for great writing, for great journalism, for, you know, fantastic information. And I think there's a lot that we can do as traditional journalism to make sure that our work is tailored to that audience of people who want to get the information, want to get the great stuff, but they aren't going to do it by going, to your point, to globemail.com or picking up the paper. So how can we do that? I mean, we can be present on those networks, be part of that discussion, be living in that space with people, and making sure that our content, something I rail on and on about, and I think everyone at the Globe is sick of hearing from me about this, but the fact that our content is sort of platform neutral, that you don't need to understand a story on a newspaper page to get it, that the headlines work, the photos work, the text works, and that when we do refer people back to that page, we are surfacing up the best stuff we've got to introduce them to the Globe and seeing every referral as a potential Globe reader. One example is that when Kirk Makin did some great reporting on the controversy over gay marriage and divorce among non-Canadian couples, and that, that just took on a whole life of its own, and it's amazing to see when you have a story that really hits a nerve and really resonates with people for whatever reason that might be, how it can just, go everywhere, and it doesn't matter, it was a front page piece, but it wouldn't matter where that played in the paper, really, if it's great information and something people are really looking for.
And then you're hoping that those people will have an affinity to your brand, I guess, and then come back again and again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we want to offer something that that people find engaging. I mean, I think that's one thing with obviously that's a Canadian-centric example, but the charter is that sort of thing that will keep you coming back, that's engaging. If you're interested in Canadian law, we've got something there for you, and thinking more, I think, expansively about what a newspaper can do and what kind of experience it can offer people.
Right. Rachel, a quick question for you. I know that during the Arab Spring, think in the newsroom on the broadcast side of the CBC, because some of my friends work there, there was a lot of debate about using YouTube video from Syria, or from Egypt, or different parts of Lebanon, different parts of Libya. I'm too been focused on local news. And I'm wondering what sort of checks and balances you do. How do you apply the rigors of journalism to this user-generated content to ensure, again, you're not denigrating your brand? You're not taking something, as Andrew said, that is purports to be one thing but is actually something much different.
You know, I think it's a bit like anything, you know, any source material that you get that comes in, you have to really go through the same evaluation process that you would do with any kind of content. The difficulty with YouTube videos or user-generated photos is that you may not be able to get in touch with the person who created that content. However, you know, there's an awful lot of information that comes along with digital material. You know, you can look at what is the network that that person belongs to. You can look at where it was uploaded. You can look at, you know, do the buildings in the videos make sense? Does it represent what you might see on the map? Basically, using your basic journalistic integrity and your journalistic instincts is the way to figure out whether it's safe to use, if you like. And the other thing, you know, once we've made the decision to actually use that kind of content, is being clear with the audience where it's come from, what we know about it, and what we don't know about it.
Being totally transparent about that.
Absolutely. Transparency is key in that respect.
Okay. And then, Dan, before I just get ready for questions out here, Dan, a question for you. You've divided up your audience in quite an articulate way, and the dilettantes and all those. But I'm wondering, you know, when you look at people that participate on news sites now, I think the feeling is 5% of the population makes, 95% of the noise. I'm wondering, do you think that as more people move to the digital space, that that will change? Do you think more people will participate and engage with content online?
The short answer is I believe that's the case. I don't have any numbers to back it up right now. I've heard what everybody else hears, that whatever it is, 10% of Twitter users compose 80% or 20-80 of the tweets. So I do anticipate that that will happen. And certainly our experience at The Agenda is that if the more that we afford people the opportunity to participate on various platforms, the more people will participate. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and what we found is also, it's not the case with some exceptions. It's not the same people who participate on Facebook, who participate on Twitter, who participate on our blogs. It's quite different, and different conversations that take place. And I would suspect that they break down demographically, and especially by age as well. But I do anticipate that the trend is only going to grow. I mean, you pointed out earlier that you think that our broadcast audience is not, or our online audience is bigger than the broadcast. Yeah. It's not quite yet. But if you actually look at the trend lines, it is heading in that direction. There's no question. Especially for the kinds of things that The Agenda produces. And we don't do news. We're not a news program. And that may be an advantage to us, or maybe a disadvantage compared with the massive undertakings that you folks have to take on. But in a sense, being freed from the rigors of daily news means that we can have a different kind of conversation with people. And for the kind of thing that we do, there's no question in my mind that at some point in the near future, I don't know when, for the kind of content that we do, we will have more people consuming what it is that The Agenda does on our various digital platforms than we will on a broadcast. There's no question about it.
Okay, great. Fantastic. Okay, well, I'm going to throw it out to the audience. The first person I actually like to point out is Chris Hogg from Digital Journal. Where are you, Chris? There you are. For many people who don't know, Chris, you've been a real leader in this field for a long time with your organization, Crowdsourcing Journalism and Journalism Content. If you could actually just throw the first question to these guys, based on, you know, you being sort of at the ground level for a long time, what's your feeling? But specifically, if you have a question for any of the panelists.
As digital has become. If you look across across the space, there's a lot of startups working in this. Digital Journals One, Open Files doing a lot of great stuff. There's a lot of big media companies that have combined citizen journalism and user-generated content, but it reminds me a lot of how digital people used to be considered. They were tucked away in a broom closet somewhere or down in the basement, and often participatory journalism gets flagged as that. When do we go from talking about participatory journalism to actually making it part of our business at scale, or do we go that route?
Dan? I can see you're ready to answer that.
It might be more appropriate for the folks who have to make money doing this to answer that question, because I do think that in some sense the answer is going to be when you can make money doing it. Actually, to be fair, I think that there is a question about being able to monetize it. The other thing, though, is that there's the other pressure. There's a relentless pressure right now on traditional journalistic enterprises. I think it's because you were talking about Syria or Lebanon, to reduce costs. And so not only is there a pressure to make money on this, but there's a pressure to be using participatory journalism as a way of reducing costs. And so I do think, my hunch is that the answer to your question is going to have to do with dollars at the end of the day. And scale will be a function of that. But yeah, as I say, you guys might have...
I don't know if I'm going to be quite as... base about the dollar. It's true. We do have to make money and we do have to reduce costs. But I think we would never sacrifice the quality of journalism, because really at the very base of what we do, it's about trust and integrity. What separates, say, Global News, the Globe and Mail, CBC, the Agenda, from a blogger who just goes on, on WordPress and starts writing? I would hope it's the trust and integrity that we have as journalists, that we know our beats, that we have a rigorous system of editing and vetting and double sourcing. There's context to what we do. That's right now missing in a lot of cases. I mean, the great writing that you got from the Iraqi soldier, I imagine, is quite a rarity. It's not the norm. I think what the norm is the comments you see on YouTube and stuff. That's the danger. So opening that gate and saying we're going to embrace it wholeheartedly and make it an essential part of our business, I think we could do that as long as we build in, checkpoints and safeguards to make sure that quality isn't eroded by it. Otherwise, it'll always be balkanized. We'll always have to say this is coming from, citizens, not quote-unquote trained journalists. And I do think there's a difference. I think there are some citizens that are better than a lot of trained journalists, but I think that going to journalism school and learning the craft and having experience does count for something. Somebody who just wants to go to City Hall every week and listen and write it, I don't think is necessarily as prepared as a City Hall reporter who's done the beat for 2 or 3 years, has mined sources, who can navigate the waters, understand, committee meeting minutes, things like that.
I just want to say it's funny when I think of the question of the value of participatory journalism. I started at local papers, small papers, and I can't tell you the amount of times I'd be assigned to go find someone, go stand on the street corner until you find someone who really cares about gas prices or whatever it is. And I just think that, and this is sort of even before Facebook and stuff like that, but I just think that for any journalist out there who doesn't see the value in what these online tools can present in terms of enhancing their reporting, making their reporting more streamlined, more effective, to immediately find the exact right person you want to talk to, I don't know what to say. I mean, for us at The Globe, obviously we have some incredible journalists who have been doing this for a very, very long time. And if I'm working with them, I mean, there's usually sort of that light bulb moment. There's an aha moment where they you can kind of connect them with this piece of information or this person they want to talk to that they probably they wouldn't have found through their traditional sources. They wouldn't have found through standing on the street corner. And it really makes their story and it makes it stand up. So to me, journalistically, I think I don't look at it as citizen bloggers. I just look at this this incredible amount of tools in this form that is now at our disposal like never before, which is incredible. And in terms of the monetizing question, that comes up obviously all the time. It's something everyone's thinking about. I just think that, for us, I look at the amount of information and how much people want to be part of that Globe community, and how they want to have a relationship and engage with that and tell us a bit about themselves. And I mean, I'm not in advertising, I'm not in marketing, but that's got to be worth something, right?
I I'd just like to add on that also. I think the point that you make, Jennifer, is really important, because I don't think it's necessarily that we would look directly to monetize community or participatory journalism, but I think that one of the important things is actually in being relevant and reflecting what people actually are interested in, you know, and you can build loyalty and you can build time spent on the site by giving people a stake in the coverage through the various means that we've talked about. And so when you've really built that connection with them, you know, people come for the news but they stay for the community, then there is a side benefit there, arguably, that potentially you could end up monetizing, although it's not something that we would particularly do directly.
But I'm sure they will. You'd like a question. Would you like to ask a question? There's a microphone at the back, but you don't have to go all the way back there. You can, it's close enough. That's fine. So for the people in the back that couldn't hear, and for the next question, except for the microphone, it's fine. No, that's fine. For the microphone is back there. The question is this new democratization of media? Are people who have a voice, are they changing politics in Canada because we're giving a voice to the voiceless, or is it a platform for people who already shout really loud in the schoolyard?
I'd like to go first, if that's okay. I think there's definitely a danger that you just sort of self-reinforce. I mean, when you look at Twitter, it is possible to see the same people speaking to one another all the time. One of the things that we tried to do during the federal election was actually to give voice to people in the regions. So, I mean, obviously Canada is a big country with a lot of things to say, but, you know, it's possible to see things from a very Toronto-centric point of view. So one of the things we made a real effort to do, and I think that's a key point, is actually to go out and look for citizens who were interested specifically in participating and talking about their ridings. And so we really had an army of people who were blogging right the way across the country that gave us a more diverse view of what was happening right the way across Canada than perhaps we would have had if we had only gone to the regular sources. One of the other things I would just say about our political coverage is that we actually are trying to change the nature of the discourse and actually have a really robust discussion every single day, actually, through our various platforms. We have a politics portal on our website, which feeds into Power and Politics every day. That in itself puts its own questions out on Twitter, which are reflected back on the program. So we're trying to broaden out the discourse to people through multiple different channels. But certainly I think the key thing is that in order to have a broad political discourse rather than a self-reinforcing one is actually making the effort to go and find the people who have things to say rather than people who just shout the loudest.
I'd also like to add that when we started OpenFile, it was a concern of ours, too, because that was our whole platform. And Kathy Vey, who is sitting over there, who helped found OpenFile with me, she pointed out very early is that if you set the tone of the conversation, the people who that you're talking about, who you fear, well, no, but you set the tone, and if it's not constructive, and if it's not adding to the conversation, and you're not getting information of it, and if you don't post that, and you are gatekeeping, they actually don't come back. And people see there's so many options online now. And Kathy convinced me of this, and I was terrified of it because I didn't want to be a gatekeeper. But we set the tone very early, and the level of conversation was astonishing to me, even on our little sites, and how people contributed and added things. And that really surprised me. And I think there is sort of a self-regulatory thing that goes online. Dan?
Yeah, I think that at its best, and I think that that's it's rare. You do get the community self-regulating. Having said that, I do think that it's very important. And whenever we do have the, for instance, for a live blog or a live chat or around a contentious or a political topic, it is very important that we dip in and make sure that we keep balance if we see that balance is lacking. But there's no question that the technology has just provided a bigger megaphone to those people who want to have a voice. And, you know, I don't know that that is any different than what the problem has been traditionally for media or for journalists. I just think it's probably a question of scope. So I think the problem still exists.
We have one question in the back, in the microphone, and I look around the pillar there. Am I right? Yeah, okay.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Rachel, you've worked in kind of both sides. It's kind of a more in a startup with now public and obviously with more traditional media outlets. And it's kind of that argument that where is the innovation going to come from? And I kind of use it kind of a business analogy where they say other companies have to die. Kodak has to die for somebody else to come in. Most companies that pre-exist can't reinvent themselves. I think IBM's a one exception, maybe Apple. Basically, the ones die along the way. So I'm just curious, maybe to start with you, and because Andrew had mentioned, yeah, we're doing all this great stuff, but again, in the newsroom, it's like doing the same thing. Let's do a streeter, which is a snooze fest if you're actually, you know, interested in content. So maybe starting with you, the difference between the where it could happen.
You know, I think innovation exists wherever you allow it to exist. I think one of the challenges that we have working in digital is actually the one that you expressed, which is, you know, how do we take it out of our small microcosm of the universe and actually expand it into our broader newsrooms? We're fortunate at CBC to work in a very integrated way. And so we work very collaboratively with TV and radio. And so we don't face, I would say, in large part, the issue of people just sort of saying, oh, no, I'm not really interested in that. I think in order to change the culture, it's about asking people why they might think in a certain way, questioning the decisions that they're making, and also showing the benefits of it. And for our part, in terms of innovating, it's about understanding what are the latest tools and techniques that are out there, thinking about how we might responsibly apply them to our journalism. So, you know, we try and innovate. You saw it with the example I gave at the beginning with the Fifth Estate, which, you know, is a very well-established, you know, legacy property, if you like, although they wouldn't like me calling it that. You know, and we're looking to expand that brand into the digital space. And so we work in partnership with TV or with radio to think about, well, what's the story we want to tell and what are the tools that we're going to be able to use to do this? So not so much thinking about innovation for its own sake, but thinking about what's the best way of telling the story or imparting that information to people and starting from there. And we've seen a lot of success with that. And I would say, you know, whenever we do something well, we make sure that we tell people about it because it makes it easier the next time around.
Okay, great. We have two more questions, two final questions from the back there. And after, don't forget, you can ask the panelists questions with drinks afterwards. So back to the microphone.
Hugh Windsor here. With the apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle, I want to ask a question of why the dog didn't bark. And in connection with the robocalls story, it seems to me that that's the kind of story that should have bubbled up from the antenna that the new platforms provide, is that something, if it is as widespread as we're now given to believe, it should have bubbled up. And it didn't until two reporters at the Ottawa Citizen with, I suspect, some help from an investigator at Elections Canada, put their fingers on what happened. Now, it's true there became an online reaction, and many of the numbers of incidences or whatever that was cited by Mr. Mehran, the chief electoral officer, was the result of the story really developing in print, and then online people added their complaints or whatever, and it exacerbated the number of complaints. But the story happened in the most conventional way of two curious and very good journalists following up and got some help from an insider. The question is, in this case, why did the dog not bark?
So maybe I'll throw that to Dan very quickly first.
I think one of the issues is implicit in the way you asked the question, which is it should have bubbled up. I think the word should is very problematic when it comes to participatory journalism because we can't say what should matter. This is the issue that I raised earlier on about apportioning importance. The fact is all of us have had, as journalists, various times in our careers where we've said, this is an important story. This should make a difference in somebody's life, or this should be something that people are going to watch or listen to or read, and they haven't. And insofar as participatory journalism, public journalism, may give us a clearer understanding of the stories that actually matter to people, we may be surprised to learn that the things that we think that should matter to people don't. That's troubling to those of us who actually believe that A, B, and C matter. But I suspect that we're going to have to get used to far more of these kinds of situations than was previously the case.
Jen?
Jennifer? Yeah, I just want to say, I think that story you tell, and you're exactly right, is kind of, I mean, to me, that's why what all of us here in this room do, why it's still relevant, why it still matters, and why it will continue to matter for quite some time. I personally think participatory journalism or open journalism or whatever you want to call it is really important and is an excellent complement. In some ways can tell a story even better than traditional journalism, but does not in any way replace traditional journalism or investigative journalism. And everything I've ever heard from our readers, no one has ever said, I don't want traditional journalism. They simply want, I think, traditional journalists to be more open and to perhaps use new tools to reach out to people. So I think that story shows why it is so important to have investigative journalists who are willing to shed light on stories that otherwise might be untold, and to have that journalistic judgment and that public service to say this is important, exactly to Dan's point, that this should be important, and to be able to get it out there to a mass audience. And I mean, I think that's, for us at the Globe, that's where we see our role as a way to connect people across the country, around the world, who are interested in similar issues such as, you know, politics. And for us, I mean, we actually were able to do a call out, and we actually, you know, said to readers, hey, did you get a robocall? Let us know. And so we sort of took a participatory measure after the fact, after the story was well broken. And we have a very nice little database now of people who got robocalls, which is very helpful in reporting.
Okay, great. And then last question from the microphone.
My name is Jerry Grafstein. I'm a former senator and now back in the media business and a co-founder of a news site called Wellington Street Post, which is 24/7 on the air. We launched it in March and we're doing one in Washington, one in the UK, one in the Middle East. All we hope will get on the air within the next year or so. A comment and then a question. In order to build this business plan, I spend a lot of time traveling around. I was invited to a conference, a very interesting conference a year ago at the United Nations on social technology, and the panels were quite frankly divided a little differently than this one, but in an interesting way. There are conventional broadcasters there, which is television, radio, and print, and then there are the social media people that were purely social media. It gets back to the gentleman's point over here, which is which and so on. And two things that became apparent to me is that both the social media and the conventional, traditional media are seeking the same thing, which is how many eyeballs, how many readers you get, how many eyeballs. Everything's measured by your eyeballs, your readership, your viewing, and so on. So the goal, in a strange way, is both the same. Having said that, when I listen to the people from the social media, there was an inherent conflict between the traditional media and the social media, and the words that we heard today are the same, which is how do we coordinate the conventional media with the new media, what's the synergies, what's the connectivity, what's the convergence. The social media people there use the word disruptive. They were not trying to build on the old system. They were trying to disrupt the old system to capture more eyeballs. And I understand the caveat. The caveat is it correct? Has it been properly checked? Is there integrity and so on? But essentially, it was a fight for audience. And so I guess my question is this. That's the comment. The question is this. Is there not an inherent conflict between really a pure social media experience when you lard on the pillars of the existing media? Now, the one story I thought that was interesting, gentleman from Global, I thought was interesting. He in effect said, in order for us to build a story, we had to go away from conventional. We had to start at the bottom up. It was from a bottom up thing. We went to the community. We did a joint venture with Wilf Steel. And at the end of the day, it was a bigger and better and more inherent story that attracted quite an amazing number of eyeballs. So I asked you that question. Is there not an inherent conflict between the old media trying to fit into the shoes of the new media when the two don't fit and they really shouldn't be going in sync? They should be contesting in their own way that particular audience or a audience.
I'd like to put that question to Andrew, if I could. Yeah.
I think the conflict exists in the practitioner with the practitioners. I don't think it exists with the users and the viewers and the readers. I think we live in a bubble, and disruptive media. It's a big, it's not. I don't want to denigrate it by saying it's a buzzword, but there's a meme out there about that. But I think users don't think that way. We see, for example, immense opportunities in a two-screen strategy where someone is watching a television show or a news program and on Twitter at the same time, or using an interactive tool, like The Walking Dead. I watch the show, and they've got a great iPad app, and it's a great way to connect with other users. So I think that we're very focused on our own kind of silos, and we're very good at building them, almost always to our detriment. And I think the users, the viewers, the readers are miles ahead of us in what they want to do. And I think they want to consume a great front page news story on the Globe and Mail if they're, in whatever context. It's Sunday morning and they're having breakfast. On the subway, they want to read an Instapaper version of a story that they downloaded. At night, they want to watch Peter Mansbridge, maybe on their iPad while they're going to sleep. That kind of, I think that they're the ones who decide, while they're going to, sorry. It's a great guy, I'm sorry. 9 years of CBC, I can't. But I think that it's a dichotomy that we're setting up for ourselves, and I think it's going to limit our opportunities. And quite honestly, we're going to lose, because I think one of the big parts of this revolution is that we've given that control, or we've lost the control to the people who consume the stuff now. I mean, we're gatekeepers in some ways, but how the stuff is consumed, we didn't invent this, and it's the user that decided the iPhone is now, the best platform to consume 3/4 of the news that they get.
And then two last comments very quickly. Rachel, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with Andrew, actually. I mean, our users are not solely confined to one platform. They're grazing right the way across platforms. And so our job as old media, if you like, is actually to keep up with them and also to help get ahead of them and to help them find their way through all of that stuff. I think one of the key issues for us now is how do we make sure that we are on all of the various distribution mechanisms. Peter Mansbridge on your iPad is a really good example of, one of the ways in which the trusted brands can now move into the digital space. And so really, from an old media perspective, if we don't keep up with that, we've really only got ourselves to blame. And so it's hard to make a distinction for me between old and new media. For me, it's all media and the way in which it's distributed. And remaining relevant is really important for any of us in order to be able to survive.
Dan?
I'm actually a little less sanguine. I think that I think disruptive is right, and I do think there's a conflict. I think that social media is a fundamentally different type of experience than a broadcast experience. And I think it has something to do with the way in which the consumer defines utility. And the challenge for me, I can't speak for you, is how do I transition, frankly, from the one to the other? The challenge originally that I expressed in trying to find some kind of synchronization between the two may not be possible. And I don't think a screen is a screen is a screen. I think that I think that broadcast is, frankly, whether it's a newspaper or radio or a TV station, is fundamentally not that different from Gutenberg in the sense that it's one to the many. And I do think that the many to the many is a profoundly disruptive change. And that's why I'm a little less sanguine, and I fear that if we don't get it, we will be left behind.
Wow, the first good fight brewing, and I'm told we have to wrap up. But we can do this after. We can keep talking after. So anyway, thank you very much to the panelists. That was fantastic. And I'd like to invite the chair of CJF back up to the podium here.
Will, thank you for an excellent job. Also fact-checking. Not only is he CEO, he's the Newsperson of the Year, according to JSource, and we'll be receiving that award at our gala on June 7th, so congratulations. Now, I hope you put your name in for the draw. This is courtesy of Alfred Hermida, who is a co-author of Participatory Journalism, Guarding Open Gates at Online Newspapers. And can I ask you to do the honors and pick a name out of the hat there, or the bowl?
I've never done this.
Nor have I. And the winner is Neeru Kumar. Okay. Once again, I want to thank BMO Financial Group for their generous support of these affairs. We have refreshments in the back and some more conversation and I guess a little dispute to resolve. And let's have a hand for Wilf, Dan, Rachel, Andrew, and Jennifer. Meeting's adjourned.